How can we help thinking sadly of the poor serpent now, at the moment when the sundial points to the hour of Joseph's marriage, which he made with another woman, and put heads and feet together with her instead of with the serpent? I have sought to forestall that natural sadness by speaking first of her, how that by now she had become once more a cool moon nun, to whom the whole affair no longer mattered. It is easier to think of her thus. Our faint remaining bitterness is quenched in the picture of her as the bigoted priestess she had now become. Besides, her tranquillity was in no danger of being disturbed by the wedding, for that took place not in Thebes, but far away, at Joseph's house in Menphe. Pharaoh, who had been zealous in the affair from the beginning, came down in person to the festivities, and most affably sat by while the stars danced in their courses. He quite literally took on the role of God, being profoundly convinced that it is not good for man to be alone. He had told Joseph almost at once how pleasant it was to be married, and, unlike God, he spoke from experience, for he had Nefertiti, his little dawn cloud, gold-edged, whereas God was always alone, and his concern was only for all mankind. But Pharaoh, like God in this, had concern for Joseph too. So, as soon as he had exalted him, he began to look about for a state alliance, which was to be just that. That is to say, very aristocratically and politically conceived, yet pleasant and enjoyable too. Not such a simple combination. But as God for Adam, so Pharaoh produced his creature, the bride, led her to Joseph to the sound of harps and cymbals, and himself took part in the wedding feast. Now, who was this bride, Joseph's graceful consort, and what was her name? Everybody knows, but that does not lessen the pleasure of telling or hearing it. It may be possible that somebody has forgotten it, or no longer knows that he knows it, and would not know what to say if asked. Her name, then, was Asenath, the maid, daughter of the sun priest at On. Yes, Pharaoh had gone high. Higher he could not have gone. To marry the daughter of the head priest among those who served Re Horakhte, it was a thing unheard of. It bordered on sacrilege, although, of course, the girl was destined in any case for marriage and motherhood, and nobody in the least wanted her to live a cloistered life and die unwed. On the other hand, however desirable and proper it was that she be wed, yet whoever should capture her was thought of as a dark, equivocal phenomenon. He was an abductor, and she was not given, but snatched. That was the attitude in her circle, though actually everything went off with the utmost propriety and according to all the conventions. But never parents in the world made more to do about handing a child over to a husband. The mother in particular was, or affected to be, quite beside herself. She could not talk enough about her inability to grasp what was happening. She wrung her hands, and behaved as though she herself had been, or was going to be, raped. She even made vows of vengeance, though less because she really meant them than because they were the proper thing under the circumstances. Now, the reason for all this was that the virginity of the daughter of the sun, though in the last analysis destined for the common lot, was invested with the shield and buckler of a peculiar sacredness and inviolability. She was uniquely girdled with the virgin girdle. She was the virgin of virgins, the idea, so to speak, of a virgin. Quite especially and exclusively, maid, the essence of maidenhood. In her case, the common noun became proper. Maiden, she was called all her life, and the husband who should make theft of her maidenhead would be, to the average mind, committing a godlike crime, though actually less criminal for being so godlike. The relation of the son-in-law to the parents of the girl, particularly to the hand-wringing mother, might be in private perfectly friendly. But in public, it was a case of strained relations, in order to bear out the theory that, in a sense, they never consented to let their daughter belong to her husband. Indeed, in the marriage contract, the condition was expressly stated that the child should not live all the year round with her sinister brigand, but should return and live as a maid with her parents, for a certain, by no means small, part of each year. But here again the condition was symbolic rather than literal. Its fulfillment only meant that the bride, in quite normal and regular way, paid visits to her parents' house after she was married. If the high priest and his wife had had several daughters, still these arrangements would refer primarily to the eldest, and to the others in much lesser degree. But 16-year-old Asenath was their only child. Think, then, of what godlike violence and unnatural crime was this man guilty who wedded her. Her father, Horakte's chief prophet, was, of course, not the same gentle old graybeard who, at the time of Joseph's first visit to On with the Ishmaelites, had occupied the golden chair at the foot of the great obelisk in front of the winged disk of the sun. He was that man's elected successor, likewise gentle, benevolent, and blithe of countenance, for thus had every servant of Atum Re to be by virtue of his office. And if he was not by nature thus, then by some necessary disguise he had to become so by second nature. Chance willed it that this priest, as we are aware, had the same name as Joseph's former owner, the courtier of light, namely Potiphera, or Petipre. And what name could be better for him in his office than the son gave him? The name indicates that he was born and destined for the office. Presumably he was the son of that old man in the little gold cap, and Asenath, accordingly, his granddaughter. As for her name, written N-S-N-T, it was connected with the goddess Naith from Sais in the Delta. It meant she who belongs to Naith, and the maiden was under the special protection of that armed goddess, whose emblem was a shield with two arrows fastened crosswise on it, and who, even in human guise, usually wore a cluster of arrows on her head. Asenath did. Her hair, or rather the conventional wig she wore over it, the construction of which left it a little uncertain whether it was a coiffure or a headdress, was always adorned with arrows either thrust through or fastened on top. While the shield, in token of her peculiar virginity, appeared as an ornament at throat or waist or on her armbands, accenting, together with the crossed arrows, the inviolable character of her maidenhood. Despite all this armor and outward emphasis upon her inward resistance, Asenath was a charming child, highly sweet-natured, gentle, and biddable, obedient to the wishes of her aristocratic parents, to Pharaoh's will, and to her husband's, even to the point of having none of her own. It was precisely this combination of sacred and inviolate purity, with a definite tendency to let people do what they would with her, a tolerant acceptance of her feminine lot, which was the essence of Asenath's character. Her face was typically Egyptian in shape, small-boned, with somewhat prominent lower jaw. But it did not lack individuality. The cheeks still had their childlike roundness. The lips were full, too, with a soft hollow between mouth and chin. The forehead chaste, the little nose perhaps a thought too thick. The large, beautifully painted eyes had that peculiarly fixed and expectant gaze which is typical of the deaf. But Asenath was not deaf. Her gaze only reflected her inner expectancy. It was as though, with conscious readiness and acceptance, she was waiting for the hour of her destiny to strike. This faint unearthliness in her face was more than made good by the dimple coming and going in one cheek as she talked. The whole effect was rarely charming. Charming and a little unusual her figure was, too, as seen through the spun air of her garment. The waist exceptionally small and wasp-like, the hips and abdominal cavity, by contrast, ample and spreading, a good womb for childbearing. The breasts stood out like little twin bucklers. The arms were slender and shapely, with large hands which she habitually held with the fingers spread out. Portrait of a maiden in amber. Such was the whole impression Asenath gave. Until her marriage, she had led among flowers a life like theirs. Her favorite spot was the lake shore in her father's temple grounds, a rolling meadowy stretch carpeted with narcissus and anemones, where she loved to wander by the mirror-like waters with her playmates, the little daughters of the priests and the aristocracy of On. There she plucked her flowers, sat in the grass, and wound her garlands, her listening look fixed upon space, the brows lifted, the dimple coming and going in her chin, wholly expectant of what should come. And then it came. For one day, Pharaoh's messengers appeared on the scene. From Potiphera, father and priest, heavily nodding assent, and from the mother, who was quite beside herself and wrung her hands, they demanded the virgin Asenath for wife to Jepnutif Onech, vice Horus, and shadow dispenser of the king. She herself, possessed by the one idea of her existence, flung up her arms to heaven, imploring aid. But they snatched her round her tiny waist and tore her away. All that was just a farce, a symbolic performance dictated by convention. For not only were Pharaoh's wishes law, but a marriage with his favorite and first mouthpiece was highly honorable and desirable, and the parents could not have looked higher for their child than Pharaoh had looked for Joseph. So there was no reason at all for desperation or even for grief going beyond the natural pain of parents at parting with their only child. But there had to be much ado made over Asenath's virginity and the theft of it. It was necessary to portray the bridegroom as a sinister character, however pleased the parents had reason to be, and in fact probably were. Pharaoh had expressly given out that virginity here espoused virginity, that the bridegroom too was in his way a virgin, long wooed and set apart, a bride whence now the wooer issued. To this end, he had had to arrange matters with the god of his fathers, the bridegroom of his race, whose jealousy he had long spared, but now no longer spared, or spared only in so far as he was making a very special kind of marriage, a proper virgin marriage, if that helped matters any. We, of course, need feel no concern, despite all the implications of the step, for Joseph was making an Egyptian marriage, a marriage with Sheol, an Ishmael marriage, and thus a marriage not without a precedent, though a doubtful one, in need of all the consideration which, it appears, it was sure to receive. Our teachers and expounders have, many of them, taken exception to this marriage of Joseph's, and even sought to deny the fact. In the interest of purity, they have put it about that Asenath was not the child of Potiphera and his wife, but a foundling, and no other than the offspring of Jacob's own unhappy daughter, Dinah, exposed and found floating in a basket. According to this theory, Joseph took his own niece to wife, which, even if it were true, would not greatly improve matters, because half of Dinah's child was flesh and blood of the fidgety Sychem, a Baal-worshipping Canaanite. Anyhow, our reverence for our teachers must not prevent us from pronouncing the story of the child in the basket to be what it is, an interpolation and pious fraud. Asenath the maiden was the real child of Potiphera and his wife, of pure Egyptian blood. And the sons she was to present to Joseph, his sons and heirs, Ephraim and Manasseh, were, whether we like it or not, simply half-Egyptian by blood. And even that was not all, for by his marriage with the daughter of the sun, Israel's son came into close relations with the temple of Atum Re, priestly relations, in fact, as had been part of Pharaoh's plan when he arranged the marriage. It was almost unthinkable that a man as high in government preferment as Joseph was should not at the same time have performed a higher priestly function and drawn a temple revenue. And, again, whether we like it or not, Joseph, as Asenath's husband, did both. In other words, and to put it rather baldly, he had an income from the idolaters. To his official wardrobe henceforth belonged the priestly leopard skin, and under certain circumstances he was liable to burn incense officially before an image, that of the falcon Horacte with the sun disk on its head. These things have been well understood by but very few people. To have them thus clearly stated may come as a shock, but it is quite clear that for Joseph the day of enfranchisement was now come, and we may be sure that he had known how to reach an understanding with him who had parted him from his own, transplanted him to Egypt, and made him great there. Perhaps we have here an application of the philosophy of the triangle, according to which a sacrifice at the alabaster table of the complacent Horacte meant no derogation from any other godhead. And after all, this was not just any temple. It was the temple of the god of the far horizon. Joseph might put to himself that it would have been a mistake, a piece of foolishness, in other words, a sin, to ascribe to the god of his fathers a narrower horizon than to Atum Re. And finally, we must not forget that the Aton had of late emerged out of this god. In the conversation between Pharaoh and Joseph, it had transpired that one properly invoked him not by the name Aton, but as the Lord of Aton, not as our Father above, but as our Father who art in heaven. All this may have passed comfortably through Joseph's mind when, on certain rare occasions, he put on his leopard skin and went to burn incense. All in all, Rachel's eldest, Jacob's parted darling, was definitely a very special case. The indulgence vouchsafed him took account of the things of this world, and that in turn prevented things from ever coming to a tribe of Joseph as it did to a tribe even of Issachar, Dan, and Gad. His role, his place in the plan, was that of a man set in the great world to be, as we shall see, guardian, provider, and savior of his own. There is every reason to think that he was aware of this function, at least emotionally, and thought of his own exiled and cosmopolitan existence not as that of an outcast, but as that of a man set apart for a purpose. Undoubtedly, this is the explanation of his supreme confidence that the master of the plan would treat him with due consideration and forbearance.